Session number 10430, Reel 1.
Can you tell me what your attitude was towards the Japanese enemy before you actually met him?
Well, of course, we knew absolutely nothing about the Japanese. I knew nothing about the Japanese. I was a junior captain in the 4th Monmouthshire Regiment, 38th Welsh Division, in 1941, when the colonel sent for me and said, Gadsden, I've had a senior major and 2 senior captains posted to the battalion. I don't want them, but they're here, and you revert to lieutenant. So I said, well, that's hard luck, sir, isn't it? I've only just been made captain. And he said, well, you can always do this. And he threw a piece of paper across the table at me, and it said, middle peace officers wanted for the Indian Army. Can you ride a hoss? And so I said, no, sir. He said, you'll bloody soon learn. And as for the language, simple. I was there for 20 years, can't speak a bloody word. And that was how I came to go to India in the first place. And arrived there very raw and knowing nothing about the Indian people and certainly a great deal less about the Japanese.
Which particular part of the Indian Army did you go into?
Well, first we were all sent draft RAXAG, R-A-X-A-G, we were all sent to Bangalore to acclimatise. And it's a wonderful place to acclimatise and begin to learn the language because nobody speaks anything but Malayalam and Telugu, and you're trying to learn to speak Urdu. So mostly we spoke English in Bangalore, and we were there for about 2 months. And then all the officers were posted to their battalion that they were going to. And I was posted off to the 4th Battalion, the 14th Punjab Regiment, which is a regular battalion. And at that time, it was located at Bukriol. And Bukriol is 40 miles north of Abbottabad. And I thought that it would be fairly simple to get to wherever they were posted, and they'd be in a nice cantonment of some sort. And in fact, it was certainly 5 days' journey, if not more, because we went first from Bangalore to Bombay, from Bombay to Jhansi, Delhi, Lahore, and then Havilion, where we were put out on the platform on the terminus of the railway at Havilion to find our own way first to Abbottabad to spend one night, and then from Abbottabad up to Bukriol, riding on the top of a load of potatoes going up to the battalion, I remember, with the quartermaster. So that was how I arrived with the 4th 14th Punjab Regiment.
What did you think of your Punjabis once you first came across them?
Well, of course, you really did get to like the native Jawan in the Indian Army. If you were going to be any good at the job, you really got to love these chaps because it was the biggest standing army in the world. They were all volunteers. There wasn't one man who was pressed into service. Every man was a volunteer. And the setup normally was that in the village there wasn't enough land for the family all to be on the land that they owned. So the senior son normally worked on the land. The second son certainly went into the army. And the third son very often went into the Indian police. And that was the setup. And a very good one, because they were all volunteers. They were wonderful chaps. And I must say that they saved my life on many occasions, and I well remember being hauled up a mountainside outside Kohima by a couple of strong Sikhs who put one arm under each shoulder when my legs had completely cramped up and I couldn't go any farther, and we'd got to get to the top of the hill. And they just picked me up and carried me up. And these were the sort of chaps you got to rely on them, and they relied on the British officers. And that was how the Indian Army worked, in my opinion. Trust between the British officers and the Jawans themselves.
What was the composition of the 4th, 14th Punjabis?
The 4th, 14th was A Company Sikhs, B Company Dogras, C Company were Punjabi Muslims, and D Company were Pathans. And of course, they each had their particular foibles. The Sikhs grew a big beard, and nothing must ever cause them to cut their hair, and to offer them a cigarette was an insult. So you very quickly had to learn the Sikhs had those two peculiarities. The Dogras were very high caste Hindus, and for that reason you had to be extremely careful if you went down into their lines that you didn't cast your shadow either across the water degchi, the tank that they had, or you didn't cast your shadow on their food, because if you did, they were extremely likely to throw the food away. The Punjabi Muslims were perhaps the most tolerant of the lot, but of course their religion bans alcohol. Sometimes they were a little bit inclined to overlook this fact that alcohol was banned, but by and large I think that they didn't in any case drink to excess, nor could they have got any drink. The Pathans, you have to watch their honour. Pathans have a very high sense of honour and can easily be insulted. And by this, I mean that on one occasion, as I recall, we'd had a very long march in hot weather, and the colonel said to me, "Set up your company headquarters under that big tree." And I went over there and found that a platoon of Pathans had grabbed this place in the shade. Whereupon I said to the Havildar, "Yeh Hamara headquarters hai, this is my headquarters." And he said, "Nay, Saab, Hamara, no, Saab, it's mine." And I said, "Oh, God." And he said, "Sahib ne galidia, Saab has sworn at me." And this is something, of course, to a Pathan, his honour has now been attacked, and he's liable to set up a blood feud. And if you are involved in a blood feud with the Pathans, then the family will follow you until blood is let. And the only way really to get over this problem is to get all the viceroy's commissioned officers of the battalion together, sit down in a circle and talk the thing out and explain that saying, "Oh God," is not really such a bad swear word. It's not really swearing at the individual. And this was done, and I was duly forgiven, but one has to watch it, because, of course, in war, there are all sorts of scores settled in the heat of a battle amongst people themselves.
Did you have any personal preferences for the different communities?
Well, not really. I was set off as A Company commander with the Sikhs, so I had a particular feeling for the Sikhs. But B Company I fought with quite a bit, because as the battalion had casualties in action, you were very much inclined to take two platoons of B Company and one platoon of D Company. But I suppose the Sikhs and the Punjabi Muslims were my favourites. I was in command of C Company as well, the PMs, for quite a long time. And my orderly was, in fact, a Punjabi Musliman, a chap named Waris Khan, and he was with me right the way through all the actions in Burma and saved my life on more than one occasion.
Some people nowadays try to make a point about divide and rule in relation to the Indian Army by saying that the British use divide and rule tactics by keeping Hindus in one unit, Muslims in another unit, Sikhs in another unit. Do you have any comments on that allegation?
Well, to my mind, that is ridiculous. We were, in fact, an integrated battalion where we had the four rifle companies, yes, but the headquarters company was all mixed troops, although, of course, they had to have their own kitchens and they ate their own food and so on. But we integrated so well, you would never have believed that there was any problem between Hindu and Muslim in the army, just none at all. They all accepted orders that were given. There was never any rivalry other than good friendly rivalry in hockey matches and all this sort of and the sports that we used to play. And we did play a lot of sports in the Indian Army, of course.
Do you think it would have been possible to mix the different religions in the same company?
Yes. I had at one time Jats and Sikhs in A company. Although they are very closely related, the Jats are Hindus and the Sikhs are Hindus as well. And Sikhism is in fact rather like being a nonconformist in the UK. You're not born a Sikh, you become a Sikh. You're born a Hindu, Jat or whatever it is. But yes, we had Jats and Sikhs mixed up. I've gone out, as I say, on many occasions with two platoons of Dogras and a platoon of Pathans, and they always operated very well together, no problems.
Now, can you tell me how you came to go to Burma?
Yes. So we got as far as Bakriol, where the 7th Indian Division was being put together in 41... in 42, and we moved from Bakriol first of all down onto the plains to catch up with our motor transport in November 1942, and I remember that we moved as an advance to contact, as though there was an enemy ahead of us, and we manoeuvred, and I was told to cross the Kaubal River with assault boats. And I can still remember this day very well, when we crossed the Kaubal River, supposedly, in assault boats, which were folding boats. You just pulled the sides up and put struts of wood in and paddled across. And that was fine. We were delivered the boats at the edge of the river, and I put my troops in. And you could see the far bank ahead, and we paddled across. And when we walked up the bank, we found to our horror that what we'd done was to cross the near side stream of the Kaubal River. And there ahead of us was the river, and it was coming down off the snows with big standing waves, and it was doing about 20 knots. And there was just no possibility of launching this type of boat in that sort of water without getting somebody drowned sooner or later. And I wondered whether I should disobey orders and refuse to cross the Kaubal River, or what on earth I should do. We tried putting one boat in, and it was almost immediately carried away, and you could see farther out in the main river where these big waves were. You were just going to get swept away. So I thought, well, nobody will really thank me for getting some chaps drowned. So I pulled the boats out and went back again, and we went and found the nearest bridge and crossed over that way, which seemed to be a much more sensible idea. But there we were. We went to Nowshera. From Nowshera, we were put into trains and put all the transport onto flat trucks. And we went to Nagpur in the central provinces. And from Nagpur, we went 120 miles to Nowshera and trained in jungle warfare, in thick jungle down there. In fact, we had a tiger kill just outside the camp, and the head man wanted me to go and sit up for this tiger because he said it had killed some people as well. So I asked the colonel, but he wouldn't let me go. He said that I'd only succeed in wounding the thing, and if I did, I'd have to follow it in the jungle, and he wasn't prepared to take the consequences. So I never got a tiger shoot. From Central Province's jungle training, I went in July 43 into the Arakan in Burma, the first person in, and went in just to see what conditions were like down there ahead of the battalion and do some patrols with the troops that were down there. And I was there for some time getting ready for the battalion to come in. And the battalion came in September 43, and that was alongside the Kalapanzin River at Bawley Bazaar. We came in and marched in over the famous Gopi Pass and took up positions late 43 south of the village of Gopi, and I suppose 15 miles from Boothidong, which was held by the Japanese. And we used to patrol out into the Boothidong area. The no man's land then was 4 or 5 miles across, and you used to go out for 4 or 5 days at a time, carry your rations with you, and try and catch the Japanese who were looting villages and getting food and so on, and just try and beat them up and get the feel of the area. And that's what we were doing in those days. That's how we arrived in Burma.
Can you tell me what kind of mental preparation you gave to the Jawans for meeting the Japanese?
Yes, well, everybody was pretty scared of the Japanese, including, I suspect, some of the officers as well, because they did have this aura of being almost invincible. They'd come up through from Malaya in the first retreat from Burma. They'd outmarched us, they'd outfought us, and they really did seem to be rather supermen. And it was only, I suppose, after the arrival of Mountbatten that things began to change, that people began to think that perhaps we could stand and fight the Japanese. And of course, it was February 44 in the Arakan. It was the first time we actually stood and fought them. And I was very much involved in that. And I remember the day very well because it was my birthday, the 4th of February 1944. And by then, we'd got forward from where we were at Gopi right up to the outskirts of Boothidong. We'd been gradually pushing forward over a month, 2 months, and we were prepared for an assault on Boothidong, and the Japanese beat us to it. And the way it was done was really fascinating, because the Arakan is a land of small spiny hills and flat paddy fields in between. The spiny hills are completely jungle covered. And what one does as an infantryman in that sort of country is to occupy the spiny hill right up on the top in the jungle and put out standing patrols down below on the paddy fields to see that there's nothing very much going on down below there. And the paddies are only a quarter of a mile across something. Then you come to another very steep little hill, all running north and south along the line of the Kalapanzin River. And we were, in fact, forward on one of these hills on the night of the 4th of February with a standing patrol out in the paddy fields when the patrol heard some troops coming and said the usual challenge, halt, who goes there? And some Indians replied, Tikai Bai, it's all right. Fikanay, don't bother, no problem. And they walked straight past them. And the sentries came and reported this to us. The Arakan is very thick mist overnight, and the mist hangs about 20 feet high. We could see absolutely nothing, but this column appeared to have gone through our position, heading back towards Gopi, and we all took it to begin with that this was just some of our own troops who'd sent down a ration convoy or something, or ammunition convoy, and were going back around dawn. In fact, it wasn't that at all. It was a whole regiment of Japanese with the Indian National Army outside them forming a screen, and the Indian National Army were pushing the sentries aside, saying, Tikai Bai, and the Japanese marched up the middle. And nobody would believe that this was possible, because there weren't any shots fired until, in fact, this column arrived at Gopi, where our rear dump was. And they attacked the dump and killed a number of our people. And of course, we heard firing behind, and then we knew there must be some sort of problem. And I remember that our carrier platoon commander, the Bren gun carriers, Pierre Gould, Jemadar Pierre Gould, Pathan, sent a carrier out into the fog to find out what on earth was going on, and came back with a dead Japanese on the back of the carrier and said, now what do you think of that? And that was the first that we knew of this attack in the Arakan, which led to a whole regiment moving behind the 7th Indian Division. And instead of running away, which was what had always been done, the Japanese are behind us, we're cut off, we must withdraw. Everybody agreed, from Southeast Asia Command down to our own General Maservi, that we should form a box all round and stay where we were, because the arrangements had been made by then to supply us by aircraft, Dakota aircraft, so that our rations came in by aircraft, and the Japanese Air Force only appeared about a couple of days, and our own fighters saw them off. So we weren't worried by being bombed or anything, but we were extremely worried by the ferocity of the Japs attacking the Nakidok box, which is the famous Nakidok box, which was on the east side of the Kalapanzin. And we were, of course, on the west side of the River Kalapanzin in the lesser-known box, which was called the Quazon box. And we stayed in the Quazon box for about 4 weeks and stood and fought all round. Wherever the Japanese attacked us, we fought back. But really, it wasn't anything compared to the ferocious battles that went on in the Nakidok box, where the divisional headquarters were, and fighting hand to hand and all the rest of it. And one has heard and read of the attacks on the hospital and so on. But our job was really much easier, and we very quickly started putting out patrols to find out where the Japanese were. And after 3 or 4 weeks, we joined up with the main box over on the Nakidok side and just left patrols on our side of the river. And it was after that that when we were relieved finally, the tanks came over the pass over the Mayu Range, and Admiral Mountbatten came in. And he sent for his usual soapbox to stand on, and then said, break ranks, chaps. I can still see him saying this, break ranks, chaps. And everybody crowded round, and he said, now, he said, you may not think you've been winning this war. And we were a fairly scarecrow lot of figures by then, and rations hadn't been all that good and so on. We'd had a tough fight, and there were much muttering here, here, and so on. And I remember what he said. Well, you heard of the Quebec Conference, and they had there Churchill, and they had Stalin, and they had Roosevelt. But now they've asked me to join them, so you'll be all right from now on. And, you know, the chap had such power over men that had he said to us, we're off to Tokyo, I want you to follow me, we should all have followed him. He had great charisma, had Mountbatten. He knew how to handle men and make it all seem simple and a joke.
What do you think was the source of his power over men?
Well, it was just his charm. I don't think that he was such a marvellous tactician, and like the rest of us, I suppose he made mistakes from time to time. But he had tremendous charm, and of course he did his homework. He always knew all his people. One's read that he kept pictures of all his people and their life history and so on, so that he could always talk to anybody about any subject. And I think he had tremendous charm.
What about his uniform? Was it immaculate or dishevelled?
Oh, yes, yes, very much so. Yes, this mixed uniform of Navy and Army and all the rest of it. He didn't exactly look like a naval officer, and he certainly didn't look like an Army officer. Because, as I recall, he wasn't wearing khaki. He was wearing some white shirt and so on. But when he was with the troops, he wore military sort of an outfit, sort of bush jacket type of outfit.
But was it immaculate or sweat stain?
Oh, very much so. Very immaculate, yes. Yes, it was. Yes.
So, after Mountbatten's visit, could the men understand what Mountbatten was saying, by the way?
Well, he was speaking to all the British officers. He didn't, in fact. I don't suppose we would have dared stand down the troops, because the situation was so chaotic, and the Japanese were still about in the jungle. So people had to stand to their positions while he was in there. It wasn't sort of all over. He came in only a day or so